This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to your weekly podcast, Into England's Past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can catch us with new episodes every Thursday, so make sure you subscribe and give us a rating. Now, this week, we're delving into the history of the defence of Northern England. We'll investigate the changing border between England and Scotland and the great fortifications and castles of the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria. And we'll also find out what roles they've had in more recent times. With us to help construct the story of Northern England's defences over the centuries is properties curator Mark Douglas. Hello, Mark.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for coming back to the podcast. Last time we were with you, we spoke about Hadrian's Wall, and this time we're in the same region of England. Let's get into it, I suppose. Can you tell us how much the border between Scotland and England has changed over the centuries? I'm guessing you're going to say a lot.
Yeah, quite a lot. It's disputed territory for a lot of years, so basically it's an ebb and flow of influence back and forward across the River Tweed, I suppose, essentially.
So it's almost like a tide, you know, just sort of, you know, Scottish influence at one stage, English influence, and then it sort of flip-flops.
Yeah, it's basically based on distractions. When the Scots are distracted, the English invade Scotland, and when the English are distracted, the Scots come south of the border into England. So it's sort of a game of sort of one-upmanship and cunning and who can do the first thing first, you know?
Yeah, almost cat and mouse, seizing territory and then waiting for the counter-attack, etc., etc. So how far back are we going then in the centuries to when this argument started?
Somebody, myself included, would like to go back as far as the Roman period to think about the borders, but I think really we need to start off just after the Romans left Britain in the early 5th century and think about sort of how the notion of England and the notion of Scotland sort of came into being around that time and how it sort of progressed right through to the Union of the Crowns in 1603.
So after the Romans did leave Britain, around AD 400, I think it was, wasn't it? 410. Who fought over this sort of northern area next?
Well, the Germanic invaders that came across into England lay empty by the removal of the legionary forces basically split Great Britain up into a series of separate kingdoms. The one we basically think about here is Northumbria. At that time, Northumbria was probably the most powerful kingdom out of the several in England. And it was absolutely quite huge, and it stretched from the Humber in the south and up at some point as far as Stirling, basically north of Edinburgh. So the Northumbrian kings controlled huge swathes of territory, both what we think now is a north of the border and south of the border.
That's a lot of area to be arguing about, isn't it? It's not how we look at it today.
No, of course not. And, you know, we assume that there will have been a native population in the area, so there would be obviously some resistance. But, you know, this does come to fore later on, of course, when a distraction happens. We get the Vikings invasions and that sort of thing. And, of course, once somebody's trouble is also somebody else's opportunity.
You've described quite a vast area there. So if people have got their maps out, they should be able to get a sense of how much territory we're talking about here. Was there a key battleground in this particular area that was always being fought over, like a no man's land?
Not so much as that, really, but it's just that once these kingdoms were waxing and waning, so basically across the 9th and 10th century, Northumbria's influence wanes somewhat. Other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms come to the fore, and of course we end up with Wessex after the Viking invasion and following the period of peace, following the reign of Alfred the Great, we get a resurgence of Wessex, the Kingdom of Wessex, moving north, and that's when we get the sort of disputed territory in the north of England and across the border into Scotland.
So how far does Wessex go up then in Anglo-Saxon times? Because obviously if we think of Wessex today, we think of sort of Dorset and a bit of Wiltshire and a bit of Devon, that sort of area, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's effectively it, actually, to a certain extent. And then there's two kingdoms, the Kingdom of Wessex and the Kingdom of Mercia, and they both come together under the influence of Alfred the Great. And it's once those two kingdoms come joined together, then we start moving and pushing back the boundaries of the Kingdom of Wessex, which eventually results in the Kingdom of England. One of the major events is with King Æthelstan, who was the grandson of Alfred the Great, who basically pushed further north and actually into Scotland itself. This was followed by a resistance from north of the border. There was a coalition between Constantine, the King of the Scots, Owain, who was the King of Strathclyde, and Olaf Guthrason, who was the King of Viking Dublin. And they basically all got together and invaded England. And they were met in battle by Æthelstan at the famous battle, decisive battle of Brunanburh, which nobody knows actually where it is, but there's some contenders, but certainly in northern England. And it was after this that basically that was the whole of the country came under the rule of Wessex, and we can sort of start talking about a unified England at that point.
Right, and what year was that?
The Battle of Brunanburh was around 937.
So in 937, can you just describe the map for us then? Wessex and Mercia are sort of mostly England, is that right?
Yep, and basically the Kingdom of Northumbria, which was then becomes part of the wider English kingdom, is still sort of disputed in the sense that, you know, the people of Northumbria still feel themselves as being an independent nation. But it wasn't until King Edmund, who comes after Æthelstan, basically unites the whole of England together itself to sort of the very end of the 9th century.
And meanwhile, what's going on, what we would term north of the border today, but obviously at this point it's sort of a bit more murky. Whilst the English are sort of coalescing and starting to find an identity, what's going on north of the border?
Well, we have basically everything that's going on in Macbeth. So there's a big power struggle for domination in Scotland. Scotland's always been slightly divided by the Lowlands and the Highlands, of course, and a lot of the clan chieftainships of that. But eventually they did come together, and there was, again, another one of these instances where there's a distraction somewhere and somebody takes advantage of it. So the next major thing that takes place is the Battle of Carrum on the Tweed. And this takes place in 1018, a distinctive date because it's the date we have Ethelred the Unready on the throne. And his reign was particularly troublesome, and he was particularly troubled with Viking incursions, Viking raids on the east coast. So the Scots took full advantage of this and basically beat the English in battle at Carrum, and that is when the border was then firmly fixed on the River Tweed.
Whereabouts are we talking on the map, if you can tell us? Are we looking on the east coast here?
On the eastern side of the country. The Tweed runs almost to the west of the country. So, you know, we're talking from the east coast, halfway across the country, and over to a more of a disputed area in Cumbria. Cumbria was a back and forth kind of situation, which that happens, of course, in the Norman period, which we should come on to in a second.
Of course. Largely speaking, this battle was taking place on the east coast, Northumberland, effectively.
Yeah, towards the east coast, Northumberland, yeah.
Whereabouts would be a modern location?
Coldstream, the border town of Coldstream. It's not far from Coldstream itself, a bit further north of Wooler, 15, 20 miles inland.
And then, of course, as you've intimated, a next key marker in the story of England developing is the Norman invasion in 1066, the date that every school person knows. That obviously takes place in southern England, though. So what problems did William the Conqueror come across when he eventually moved north?
Well, of course, William is another one who takes advantage of a disputed and a rather unsmooth transition for kingship from the Earl of Wessex to Harold II. So the English nation at the time was not completely joined up in the way they thought about stuff. So William takes advantage of that. Of course, he wins the Battle of Hastings. He can start moving up through England. But he does encounter a vast amount of resistance, particularly in North of England. The Northumbrians themselves were independent, minor people. They hadn't fully supported, I don't think, the earls of the local region hadn't fully supported the succession of Harold. And they were resistant to Norman rule. And because of their close contacts across the North Sea, in Denmark and Sweden and Norway, there was a potential threat, so it had to be dealt with. And that's what William did, rather brutally, and basically put down any risings and put down any thoughts that things were going to change anytime soon. But this did allow the threat of north across the border in Scotland to remain, and he had to think of a solution for that one too.
Are you saying that William had to deal with invasions still from Viking Scandinavia?
Yeah, there were threats. I mean, obviously there'd been the invasion in 1066 itself with the battle of Stamford Bridge, but there was also threatened invasion fleets all the time on the horizon, metaphorically on the horizon, one or two unsuccessful, one or two that didn't even leave Scandinavia. But it was always a problem, always a threat. It was always alliances to be made against the Norman rule. And of course, England was such a wealthy and prosperous country that everyone wanted a part of it, you know.
As William gets older, he then has his heirs. How did they maintain their power in the region?
Well, the first thing we need to think about is that how William dealt with this. William was a man of action and a man who didn't sort of beat about the bush. He basically invaded Scotland in 1072, and he received homage from the King of Scots, Malcolm III. And this was basically, you know, how you ruled them days. You had a king, you had a client king, you did homage, feudal homage, and things were peaceful for a while. But on top of that, the Normans then had to make to back up that one piece with a show of strength. And what they did was they built castles. This is where the Normans do differ slightly from what we went before. There was no real permanent defences on the northern frontier after the Romans had left. But there was certainly with the Normans, with the building of Newcastle in 1080. There was a line of castles stretched across the border. All at this point, earthen and timber, Motte and Bailey type or ringwork type castles. But the first two castles that we're thinking about at this particular period are Newcastle and Carlisle. Strange enough, both built on either end of Hadrian's Wall, but I think that was a real consideration. But both these castles were essentially first constructed in earth. But then what we needed then was a reliable and more permanent structure, and storm came into this.
You've discussed there, Mark, the development of castles, Motte and Bailey, earthwork and timber structures, which eventually gave way to some more permanent stone structures later on. Once William has passed away, what happens then? Presumably his heirs come to the fore and they also make some fortifications in the north, do they?
Yeah, the achievements of William were built upon by his heirs. Other than the castle at Norham, which there's a very, very famous castle at Norham, which is again on the Tweed, that part of the border was too important to leave to anybody that could be accused of or even thought of as might be slightly treacherous. So it was left to the church, and that part of Norhamshire, as they called it, which is North Northumberland, came under the auspices of the Bishop of Durham. So the Bishop of Durham was also instrumental in the defence of the north. But certainly the castles that we think about as the main ones, as Carlisle, for example, Newcastle and Berwick, were all castles, and they were built in stone by the future heirs or the successors of William the Conqueror.
Could you give us a few names?
The major stronghold is Carlisle. This was begun by Henry I in 1122. He started construction of the Great Keep there. That was captured by an invasion force of David I of Scotland before the construction was complete, and it was David who finished the keep. And then also David I of Scotland went on to recapture much of northern England, down as far as into southern Northumberland and to northern Cumbria. But he was thwarted his ambitions by stretching himself a little bit too far, and he gets himself down into North Yorkshire, where he was defeated by the armies of King Stephen at the Battle of the Standard, north of Northallerton in North Yorkshire. So this is far these people penetrating down into the country. And then Henry II took back all the territory lost by treaty, and then push the border back north to where it lies today.
Right, that's really interesting. So if it weren't for Stephen the First, and the only Stephen that we've had as king, I believe,
that's the one, yeah,
then the Scots might still be occupying Yorkshire.
Yeah, I mean, this is the weird thing about it. I mean, it's such a fluid thing. It seems to me that it sort of bounces backwards and forwards across, you know, into different territories, but always seem to come back to lie on that same kind of a political fault line across the Tweed to the Solway Firth. It's there's some kind of magnetic attraction for that particular spot.
You're probably right, and the fact that being a river, it's a natural geographical dividing line, isn't it?
Well, exactly, that's right. It's quite a mighty river also. You know, it's a big feature in the landscape, yeah.
So these castles, having been established by the Norman kings, were overrun, as we've just described, by David of Scotland. Did they have a role to play in the following centuries as well? I gather there was a period called the Scottish Wars of Independence, which was brought on by this power vacuum in Scotland. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It all starts with two characters. One is Alexander III of Scotland, and the other character is King Edward I, Edward Longshanks of Braveheart fame, on the other side. Edgar himself was never one to miss an opportunity. And again, it all boils down to the same idea. Once there's something happening, once there's a vacuum, once there's a problem with the country, you make your opposition's problems your advantage. It all came about basically because the Scottish king died without an heir apparent, which was Alexander III died, and absolutely no heir apparent other than a three-year-old granddaughter who lived in Norway, who was known as Margaret the Maid of Norway. Edwin himself was all for it because Edward I thought, here's an opportunity, I'll marry my son Edward of Carnarvon, the future Edward II, to the Maid of Norway, then I get even more influence over Scotland because my son becomes a king of Scotland. And they sent for the Maid of Norway to come across to Scotland to be inaugurated as the new Scottish Queen. Unfortunately for her, and unfortunately for Scotland, she was unstopped in the Orkney Islands, which were then at that time with an outlier of Norway, and she died, unfortunately, throwing the whole thing up in the air. So then, again, not to miss an opportunity, Edward was then asked to arbitrate between several claimants to the throne, and he picked on a chap called John Baliol. And this meeting took place in the Great Hall of Berwick Castle. There's Edward's sticky hands all over Scottish politics. And it's not long before Edward and John Baliol basically fall out, and then John Baliol makes an alliance with the French, which becomes known as the old Alliance. Basically, Edward thinks very little of this and basically invades Scotland. It teaches him a lesson.
And what year is this? Is this the 1300s?
This is the very beginning of the 1300s, yeah.
Right. And people obviously might remember then the Battle of Bannockburn from the film Braveheart, which was where the Scots defeated the English in 1314. Mm-hmm. What effect did that victory have on the border and on fortifications in northern England?
Edward I himself was fairly successful in his domination of the north and particularly Scotland, and won a great many victories and was, of course, known as the Hammer of the Scots. His son, on the other hand, Edward II, didn't have the same martial qualities, and things started to go a bit awry for him. Of course, we have the uprising in Scotland, and of course we've got various charismatic leaders, including Robert the Bruce. And it was that, as you rightly say, at the Battle of Bannockburn 1314, where the English forces defeated, and Edward was sent back across the border to think again, as they say in the Scottish national anthem. This did have an effect on the fortifications of the north. The north, up to that point, had been fairly peaceful in a sense. It was, you know, invading armies moving backwards and forwards. Now it was becoming much more of a dangerous place to be. And so, what you find in the North England now, what you find in Northumbria particularly, is that now we get a lot of domestic buildings fortified. So not only do you have these huge castles of Warkworth, Dunstanburgh, Prudhoe, Norham, all those massive, you know, great piles that are sat there glowering north towards the Scots. We always have smaller places like Etal, Edlingham, and Aidan Castle. We're all effectively, although known as castles, are effectively just domestic manor houses, what we now call a fortified manor house.
The architecture is changing at that point then?
It's a complicated issue because you gained a licence to crenellate, which means you've got a licence to fortify your house. You've got that from the king. It was also a thing at the time that was it was happening all over the country, and it was also a fashionable thing. You know, you make your house look defensible, even though it's not. But yeah, in Northumberland, there was a need for a semi defence. You know, so these things were not only a cosmetic thing, they were taking place because there was raiding across that border all the time, even to the point where religious buildings... Lindisfarne Priory, for example.
Yes, I was just about to ask you about that one. That's on Holy Island, which is on the east coast in Northumberland. And that had been subject to a Viking raid, I understand, in 793. And there was also some defensive fortifications put there. You wouldn't expect it to have a defensive elements there where monks are generally being very pious and quiet.
No, but what you'll find is you're entirely right. 793 was a Viking invasion, the Viking raid, I should say, and Lindisfarne was raided quite a number of times across that period. The religious institutions, similarly to those they were in the 8th century, were isolated, kind of defenceless, and as you say, manned by peaceful monks, and they were fair game. So I don't think there's a single abbey or priory in the North England that didn't suffer at some point from the advances of the Scottish force across the border. Lindisfarne is a particular case in point because it sits out on this island, and this island was also a staging point for supplies coming up from the south of England, because the use of the navy was quite important in terms of movements across the border. So basically, unlike other priories or abbeys, Lindisfarne gets arrow loops and a barbican gate and a drawbridge and a portcullis. So it's rather well defended.
As we move into the Tudor period, we need to mention the Battle of Flodden Field, where a Scottish king was killed. That was a matter for Henry VIII. But for Henry VII, how did he deal with rulers beyond his northern border?
Henry VII was, in many ways, quite a shrewd and strategic man. I mean, we do know he fought against Richard III, the Battle of Bosworth Field. But he was more open to quiet diplomacy, and he kept the Scottish kings appeased and under treaties, and things kept quite quiet. Until we get the young James IV. As part of diplomacy, Henry would like to arrange a marriage between his daughter Margaret and James IV, which obviously these alliances work really well. It detracts from the alliance between Scotland and France. But nothing really came of it. Being a young chap, he was more interested in sort of showing his prowess and started basically raiding across the borders in 1496. It was one of those situations where there was an uprising in Cornwall. Henry was distracted by this going on, and James promptly had a go. James then came across again in 1497, which is quite an interesting one. He laid siege to the great castle of Norham. And in this siege, James was quite taken with armaments and artillery. And James brought down the great bombard, a type of cannon, of Mons Meg, which is on display now in Edinburgh Castle, which was used against the walls of Norham Castle. But the siege was unsuccessful.
And the Battle of Flodden Field, tell us what happened there.
Flodden Field comes along after the death of Henry VII, so we've got now into the reign of Henry VIII. Henry's away in France, you know, chivalric stuff in France. While at home, again, there's an opportunity. The Scots see the English king distracted by goings on in France, and James raids across the border in 1513. Takes Norham this time, no problem at all. He takes Eatel, which is a smaller castle down the road from there, but a few other border strongholds. The Earl of Surrey is sent north by the Queen and Catherine of Aragon, and he meets the Scottish king at Flodden Field in Northumberland on the 9th of September 1513. And it was a complete disaster for as far as the Scots were concerned. James IV himself was killed, along with many of his important supporters. And most of the Scottish artillery was captured as well, and that was taken to Eatel, locked up in Eatel Castle before being transported to Berwick. And the postscript to this is when Henry arrives back from France, he says, "Look at this, I've had a fantastic time campaigning in northern France. I captured a couple of small towns." Catherine of Aragon was able to turn out to him and say, "Actually, I killed a Scottish king." You know,
right.
So it didn't go down really too well with Henry in terms of his pride, as you know, you can imagine.
In the mid-16th century, we have the English Church splitting from Rome, and it was under threat from France and the Holy Roman Empire for a time. How did this issue affect the Scottish border region?
The old alliance still held true, because Margaret, the sister of Henry, did actually marry the Scottish king. It didn't lead to any massively lasting alliance, and the Scots still looked to their old friends across the Channel. There was this kind of backlash against the break from Rome, and also the treatment of Catherine of Aragon, and this sort of a coalition between France and Spain to see a reversal in the Reformation. At the same time, of course, in 1537, James V, the successor of James IV of Scotland, also sort of strengthened the alliance with the French by marrying Madeleine de Valois, who was a member of the French royal family. So the alarm bells were ringing all around England at this time. Henry put the whole country under some kind of war footing, and he was expecting invasion at any time, absolutely any time. And this had a massive effect on the architecture, defensive architecture of the country, particularly in the south and the east of the country, but certainly along the Scottish border and the other disputed areas.
I understand he built some fortifications along the Scottish border area during his reign. Is that right?
That's right. What we see is a new way of building and a new method of building which defends against artillery. Henry was extremely interested in this kind of thing. And at Berwick, he builds what we call Lord's Mount, which is built on the northeast corner of Berwick, not far from the sea. on the corner of the town walls, almost like a very, very squat, round fortification bristling with guns, with extremely thick walls intended to withstand cannon fire. A completely different thing from the tall walls of keeps, medieval keeps. Everything's very low at the ground, very flat, very thick.
Was that one of the only ones in the north that he built, or were there other ones?
One of the most effective displays of this kind of thing was done at Carlisle, where Henry contracted the expertise of a chap called Stefan van Hachenperg. Van Hachenperg was a master in defensive architecture. He started work at Carlisle. He dropped the height of the keep by one story, installing a whole array of guns on the top of Carlisle Castle Keep. He strengthened the walls, made them much, much thicker at one side, built a rampart on the inside of the wall, which is a thick earthen defence. So the facing of the wall was then backed with a big earthen bank, which on top of which again were more cannons. And he also constructed this thing called the Half Moon Battery, which is a double-decker battery that was just in front of the inner gatehouse at Carlisle, which defended a ditch so that people couldn't get from the outer gatehouse through the inner gatehouse. And the interesting thing about this thing is that there's a nice circularity to it, that the Lord Dacre, who was the Lord of the March at the time, he was the man in charge of Carlisle, also owned the dissolved monastery of Lanercost. And he brought the stone from Lanercost Priory down to Carlisle to build the Half Moon Battery. Lanercost itself was built, not exclusively, but quite a lot of, stone taken from Hadrian's Wall. So there's a direct connection between Hadrian's Wall, Lanercost Priory, and the Half Moon Battery in Carlisle Castle. These things are forever linked together.
Fascinating. Now, they stop being used by one type of people in history, they're then borrowed by the future generations. Did new fortifications continue to be built after Henry's death in 1547?
Quite rightly, the most famous and should be across all of Europe is the works that took place at Berwick. If you go to Berwick today, you'll see that the town is basically mostly surrounded by these huge, huge earthworks, earthwork ramparts and stone-faced ramparts, and these kind of bastion forts where there's got little outliers where the guns don't have to shoot at right angles to the wall, they can shoot along the length of the wall. It's all new innovations that were brought over from Italy. So Berwick was initiated by Mary Tudor, and also Edward VI, there was a star fort started to be built at Carlisle, which is a very angular square with angular pointy corners type of fort that was started to be built there, but that was abandoned in the reign of Mary with the preference to build a whole series of bastioned walls around the whole of Berwick, which then was continued again under the reign of Elizabeth I. These things were never used, they were never ever threatened.
But it's worth having them.
It's a deterrent, yeah.
In 1603, Queen Elizabeth I died, of course, childless, and the crown was passed to James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England. Was this period quite a peaceful one in terms of the old alliance and a new one for England and Scotland?
This is one of the great things that came out of that sort of union of the crowns. There was a period of relative calm and relative peace. I mean, you've got to think that being part of the union, as they say today, is a great thing, and it was seen as such by a lot of people in Scotland, that, you know, let's be part of something bigger. There was the Border Reavers, of course. The Border Reavers were individuals or families of individuals who lived either side of the Scottish borders, who basically were raiders, they caused trouble, they were, you know, a constant thorn in the side of authorities, but they weren't warring factions of two different nations across the border. So the whole thing was, the Scottish border was always a kind of a volatile place to be, but at this point it wasn't between countries, it was the volatility.
So despite the union, officially, there were these outliers, these sort of outlaws,
vigilantes.
Trying to do their own thing.
But it wasn't nationalistic. They weren't fighting for their countries, they were fighting for their own profits.
Right.
Just a bunch of gangsters, basically.
So what role did Carlisle Castle, which is one of the key fortifications in the north of England, play during this period of the new union?
Carlisle was a very interesting place. Now, the strange about Carlisle is that Carlisle Castle is often referred to as the most besieged castle in the country, and it actually isn't as such. It's more to do with the fact that Carlisle is probably the most besieged city in the country, because, again, Carlisle had a whole circuit of city walls that went around it. But Carlisle played a big part. There's two routes down through from Scotland into Northern England. One is down through Carlisle and one is down through Newcastle. And it seemed for some reason, whatever, the Scots generally took the route through Carlisle. Hence the huge castle there. So things were sort of going pretty nicely till sort of 1715 with the first Jacobite rising, which was basically trying to force the hand of the British government to reinstate the Stuart family on the throne after James II had been sent to exile after the Glorious Revolution in the later part of the 17th century. And there was, you know, a certain amount of trouble. This basically spurred the British government into doing some works at Carlisle and also at Berwick at the same time. So strengthened the walls, re-strengthened the walls. They even went as far as to build a permanent barracks. One of the first barracks ever built in the country was built in Berwick. And at Carlisle, there was barracks, there was a garrison there as well at the same time. Where Carlisle came into its own was with the second Jacobite Rising in 1745. The supporters of Charles Edward Stuart, Bonnie Prince Charlie, they basically came down to Carlisle and they captured Carlisle itself. After laying besiege to the castle for 3 days, it was handed over to them and they took up residence before moving on to Derby. So basically, the Jacobite army got as far as Derby. So again, this is, you can see how these things penetrated down to the country. Of course, by this time, the supply lines were woefully inadequate and they had to make their way back. And the follow-on from that was basically the defeat of Culloden, and it was all over.
And they were chased back into Scotland.
One of the last engagements, strangely enough, the last battle fought on English soil was in 1745 at a place called Clifton. Clifton Moor was just south of Penrith, not far from Carlisle. And it was after that, in 1546, the Battle of Culloden, and then that was it for the Stuarts.
Presumably then we move into a period where England and Scotland are living quite harmoniously and peacefully.
Yeah, obviously nobody knows the things all at the time, they don't know it's all over. There was still a tension and a thought this could all kick off again. The fortifications were under constant modification. And one of the things that was quite strange was that, the construction of the military way by the British government over the Pennines, basic on the line of Hadrian's Wall again. But this road was constructed out of Hadrian's Wall, effectively, the stone, and also sometimes on top of Hadrian's Wall. So if you drive across the military way now, across between Newcastle and Carlisle, at some point you will be driving on top of where the wall was. So it all, again, there's a great circularity to it, that these defensive positions, these splits and lines across the country, are never changed really to a certain extent, you know.
Were there any other changes made to northern English castles and other fortifications in the north after the 1700s?
Yeah, the two things come about, which is one quite a strange one. There's Carlisle Castle continues in this, and it's the threat, again, strangely, from France. And it's not just the threat of actual invasion or people from France coming across here with any bad intent. It's the idea of invasion of ideas from France. So following the French Revolution, the radical new thinking across the country and across the continent, and people striving for new freedoms, the British government certainly looked towards the northern manufacturing towns as a place of ferment where these things might have actually kicked off. And Carlisle was one of the places that was garrisoned against the possibility of a revolution within England, strange enough. That's where the use became, then these fortifications become more of a domestic thing.
What happens then to these fortifications in northern England as we move into wars which are then fought in Europe? And I'm talking about the First and Second World Wars.
Again, it surprised me, we always talk about the same two castles, but certainly the same fortifications. It's Carlisle and Berwick, and both big garrison centres. Carlisle is the centre for the military, and over in Berwick, it's the barracks, it's Ravensdown Barracks, which becomes the centre for the military establishments. Both these places became recruiting centres for the First World War, and training centres for the First World War, and also military regimental headquarters. So the King's Own Border Regiments and the King's Own Scottish Borderers.
So mustering points for troops, effectively.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
As we move into World War II, how do these castles change purpose?
There's a really great example, if you think of a northern castle, which is Tynemouth. So from Henry VIII right with to the 18th century, or late 18th century, early 19th century, the focus of attention was based around keeping the French in check and watching what they're up to, you know. As time moved through, the French domination after the Napoleonic Wars, their sort of domination of Europe wanes to some extent, or to a lot of extent, and the new power is Germany. And then you notice that if you look at the fortification, they move from the south coast, to a certain extent, to a line of fortifications up the east coast. And one of these, which was started in 1906, was at Tynemouth Castle. So Tynemouth is a medieval priory with a castle in front of it on the approach from the landward side, and there's a headland behind the priory, and on this headland there was a huge gun battery placed with 2 6-inch guns and 1 9.2-inch gun. A 9.2-inch gun is an absolutely enormous thing, could blow anything up. And this was first built just before the First World War in anticipation of a threat from Germany. Was manned through the First World War, and then was re-established in the Second World War, again with a barracks and barrack buildings on the site. And the same thing happens up in Berwick as well. There's a whole line of defences along the ramparts.
And did these locations like Tynemouth and Berwick see action at all?
No, strange enough, no. Tynemouth itself had guns looking out across the sea. Out east had guns that looked across the mouth of the Tyne to protect the Tyne. These things were never used in anger. Further south on the northeast coast, down into Yorkshire, gunboats were fired upon, but up in the north, there were major gun emplacements, more of a threat and a deterrent.
After the World Wars, what happened to the castles then? Did they stop being needed as defensive sites? Did they completely change purpose in peacetime?
Yeah, what we have is the legacy we have today. Some castles were adapted for domestic purposes, Alnwick Castle is a famous example. Some were just left to go to ruins.
Yes, and I think today we recognise these sites as part of our history, part of the landscape, and as places to visit and explore. But perhaps we also forget why they were built and how much violence they might have seen. What do you want visitors to take away having visited these northern fortifications and castles?
The perennial problem is that you are talking about places that were meant to kill people or defend people from being killed, one or the other. There's different ways of looking at different buildings, and the way they're looking at them in a political sense, say, for example, at Norham Castle, where it was used as a kind of a linchpin of the political situation. And it wasn't there to sort of basically go out and subdue people. It was there just to maintain the peace, to maintain the established order, and also to resist any incursions coming south. So there's a way to look at that building, and the way it's built, the way it's formed, to think the particular job it had to do. In essence, so I think what I'd like people to take away from this is that we think that the English heritage themselves, listed in the north of England, predominantly abbeys, the Hadrian's Wall, and a bunch of castles in Northumberland, Durham, North Yorkshire and Cumbria. And I think what I'd like people to take away is the idea that a close inspection and a close thinking about where these things are sited and what they may mean would be to show you the diversity and kind of the idea that not all castles are alike. They've all got something to say about themselves, about the people who occupied them and people who built them. And it's an illuminating subject.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we're on the trail of groundbreaking research into one of England's most enigmatic monuments.
We are in Westwoods, just southwest of Marlborough in Wiltshire, and scattered around us here are some of the sarsen stones that we think are the same type that we used to build Stonehenge.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.